dozens were killed or wounded. But why has Yemen been embroiled in a spiral of deadly conflict? The roots of the bloodshed go way back to the year 2015. Then transitional president Abdurrabbo Mansour Hadi resigned in the face of mass protests against a faltering economy and a decision to curb fuel subsidies. He was placed under house arrest but escaped to Saudi Arabia shortly after, retracting his resignation. In March 2015, Riyadh assembled a coalition of 9 Arab countries and launched an onslaught on its impoverished southern neighbor. The campaign enjoyed direct support from the West, especially the US and the UK. The aim? Restore Hadi to power. What Riyadh expected to achieve in a few weeks has not happened after more than 6 years. Instead, death and chaos run rife. Saudi warplanes have pounded Yemen regularly since the start of the war. The conflict, perpetuated by a crippling sea, air, and land blockade, has considerably worsened the condition in Yemen, which was reeling from poverty even before the war. Tens of thousands have been killed and millions displaced. Famine is now threatening a large portion of the population. Nearly 4 out of 5 Yemenis rely on aid for survival. The United Nations calls it the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The war has left Yemen nearly destroyed. The country is in urgent need of peace, but it is not clear whether Riyadh is willing to exit from its self-created quagmire anytime soon.
Joining us in the spotlight for this edition, activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joins us from Sana'a. And also Elijah Magnier, who's a political analyst, joins us from Brussels. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Hossein Al-Bukhaiti. We're looking at the battle to have restarted for Maghreb, which is an oil-rich region. If you can, please set this up for us, why Maghreb is important, what is the significance of this area, and in the bigger picture, in terms of the significance vis-a-vis the peace talks, if there are going to be any, how that plays into it.
First of all, I can explain why Maghreb is important. It's because that Maghreb is one of the largest and last cities under the control of the Saudi backed forces. And in Maghreb as well, the Saudi, when they start the war on Yemen, they start their ground attack from Maghreb, and the operation room of the Saudi coalition is in Maghreb. That's why Maghreb is in the east of Sana'a, and it was used to attack Sana'a and to attack other area. That's why it's important for Yemeni forces here in Sana'a to liberate Maghreb. And on the top of that, when they have advanced toward Maghreb, they have put an initiative to the government in Maghreb, saying that they will stop all the attack if Maghreb and the government there will not allow the city to be a base for foreign troops and for Saudi backed forces to attack any areas in Yemen and to open the road, and as well that the oil and gas in Maghreb should be distributed towards all Yemeni equally, despite in what area they are, either in areas under the control of the so-called Hadi government or under the control of Sana'a. But of course that the Saudi-backed forces has refused that, and now we are seeing them that they are crying out loud and they about this attack, and they totally forgot that the war on Yemen was launched in 2015, and that Yemeni army here in Sana'a, they have the right to liberate every corner in Yemen. And as Sayyid Abdul Malik Al-Houthi have said many times, and Muhammad Al-Houthi and all Yemeni political and military leaders, that they will liberate all areas in Maghreb. But at this point, we see that the United Nations and U.S. and other countries who are actually profiting from this war, they are crying out loud about Maghreb, and they said about millions of people who live in Maghreb, and this is actually a big lie. Before the war, there was 300,000 who are in Maghreb, not city, Maghreb province, and maybe there is maybe 100 to 250,000 the so-called displaced people. But I want to just add, we've seen that the United Nations now trying to use this humanitarian, as they say, crisis in Maghreb as a weapon. They have actually put those camps for those displaced people in the front line. They have put them in areas between Sana'a and as well between Marib City, instead of actually locating those camps in some other area. And about the oil, it's not the attack on Marib or to liberate it, it's all, as some people say, because it's rich of gas and oil. Yemen is under blockade, so even if the Houthis or Sana'a has controlled the oil field in Marib, they cannot export that oil, so there is no actually a main goal to go behind this oil field.
Well, Elijah Magner, a very good point, I believe, Hossein Abukhaiti has raised there, and that's about the fact that you have an area by the name of Marib that was really not well known when this war was ongoing, now entering its seventh year. And then when you look at the way that Saudi Arabia is losing this war militarily, and when it comes to Marib and how the Saudi fighters are making advances there, all of a sudden it's in the news, it's in the spotlight. You know, the Ansarullah are thwarting any peace efforts, and a huge deal is being made out of it. Why is Marib becoming this flashpoint when it comes to the bigger picture for Yemen?
Thank you for having me. Marib is important because it's the last Saudi stronghold, but it is more important not because of that. It's more important because the Americans are negotiating today on behalf of the Saudis. They are the ones who are involved in this war directly, and they believe that the Houthis' victory is going to belong not to Yemeni people only, but also to Iran. And the Americans cannot accept or digest that Iran has won in Syria, has won in Iraq, and is going to win in Yemen, and they were going to lose their area of control and power and hegemony in the whole area of the Middle East, at the exception of the Gulf countries. This is what it's about. It is about a city that is rich of oil, that is Al-Hudaydah is not receiving more than 10 ships, despite the agreement of the UN inspectors and allowing these ships to go through. The Americans are carrying out this blockade against the Yemeni people. Now, we hear a lot of talk about the humanitarian aspect of Marib, which reminds me of the war in Syria in Idlib, where mainstream media is talking about the humanitarian aspect of the war and why Idlib is surrounded. Well, why are we not talking about the millions of Yemeni living in Sana'a and in other side of the city that is the country that is under the control of Ansarullah, that are under the siege of the Americans and under the Saudi bombardment? That also concerns the humanitarian aspect and those concerned about the humanitarian supply to Yemen. Therefore, what we see here is the Americans are refusing to give the upper hand to Ansarullah that are winning this war, and the fall of Marib means the defeat of Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia will lose its face and will no longer be representing anything in the Middle East. They've lost against Qatar, they've lost against Yemen, they've lost in Syria, they give a damn about Lebanon, so they are out politically, and that is their last stronghold.
Hossein Abukhaiti, if we were to go back to March, that is when the Saudis actually offered a peace deal, if my month is correct here, to the National Salvation Government. Many believe that that's because Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries on the ground there are losing the war militarily. Is that an exaggeration, or is that actually true? Is that the reason why the Saudis actually offered the peace deal? What does that show when they were the ones that came out first offering this peace deal?
This is exactly what's happening. We remember that when Saudi backed forces had the upper hand and the Saudi coalition, they were a few kilometers east of Sana'a in Naim area, and they were threatened to enter the city. And we haven't seen, despite the artillery, maybe 4 million civilians who live in Sana'a. We haven't seen any of this type of crying out loud about Marib, and to offer a peace deal that the Saudi actually they want to deceive the international community. Even most of the UN and as well UN Security Council are actually fully supporting this war against Yemen. But the goal of that just to show that they really wanted peace in Yemen and they want to negotiate with Sana'a. But if we look to the articles or what the Saudi has released in that peace deal, they still consider it as a civil war. They don't want to be in front for any negotiation directly with Sana'a forces, but they want to use that as they use now the humanitarian crisis to deceive the international community and to have more pressure and to get United States more involved in the war. But if the Saudi really wanted any peace with Yemen, because they are actually losing the war, that's why they use the humanitarian situation either in Marib or as well in Yemen as a weapons and not lifting the blockade, not opening any of the airport either in Sana'a or in other area. And they show that they have actually lost or military, and they have lost as well politically, but they still try by using the United Nations and the U.S. to have pressure on Sana'a to give up or to gain goals that they have actually lost by this war. And I believe that if Sana'a actually will continue to attack Saudi Arabia, not only attacking or liberating Marib, they have actually to attack Saudi Arabia, because that's the only way that they can bring down Saudi Arabia. And we have seen now how during Biden administration, the blockade has been tightened against Yemen. There are less fuel ships and humanitarian ships that are reaching Hodeidah, despite the fact there is an agreement in Stockholm to allow all the ships to enter Hodeidah because Sana'a has actually withdrawn from Hodeidah port and other area. And the main goal of the war, last point, is actually divide and conquer. They want to separate Yemen, north and south, and as well they want to separate the south. And we have seen United Arab Emirates, they have created a group that actually doesn't recognize Hadi legitimacy. And if United Arab Emirates and Saudi and U.S. really wanted peace in Yemen, they should actually have restored Hadi government either in Aden or in Marib. But they haven't actually done that, and they want Sana'a to recognize this government. That's why the main goal is to implement the Saudi and as well U.S. and U.K. and the Zionist state policies in our region by controlling the south, controlling the coastline, and they want Marib to stay without any liberation. So Yemenis in the north will be fighting each other, and they cannot actually liberate the south. But Sana'a now have the upper hand, and they can stop that by continuing attack against Saudi Arabia.
Well, Elijah Magnier, you know, when you look at the fact of why Ansarullah, with the National Salvation Government overall, rejected the peace deal, it was some of the points made there by our guest from Sana'a, Hossein Abu Khaiti, who basically said that the elements of this so-called offer, like the reopening of Sana'a Airport, of unlimited access to Hodeidah Port, that those were not terms that Saudi Arabia was ready to settle down with. And that's when you had the wrath come down from the UN envoy and said the National Salvation Government, they don't want peace deal, they want to continue the war. Do you think that was a mistake for the Ansarullah and the National Salvation Government to not accept the peace deal that was offered to them?
Absolutely not. The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lander King, is trying to negotiate humanitarian support in exchange of a ceasefire. And he can't do that because humanitarian support is separated from the ceasefire and the end of the war. If the Saudis and the Americans, and we better talk about the Americans rather than the Saudis, because Saudis here are very marginal. If the Americans are willing to stop the war, they lift all sanctions, they lift all siege, the maritime siege, the airport, and they allow the supply to enter to Yemen through Hodeidah and through Sana'a Airport. And then they can sit and talk about the ceasefire, and they have to stop bombing, because Saudi Arabia hadn't stopped bombing Yemen until today. Therefore, they are not serious in a asking for a ceasefire and blaming Ansarullah of not accepting the deal. There is no deal so far. What they are offering is, we give you food and you stop the ceasefire, we stop firing at us. This is not a deal. There is no deal under the table that is acceptable by Ansarullah.
So Hussein Abu Qaiti, since we don't have much time left, I'm going to get right to the point of Marib. And let's imagine, hypothetically speaking, that the Ansarullah fighters make their advancements and retake that region, which, as you mentioned, is the last stronghold. They control the north and central highlands. So with the win, hypothetically speaking, of Marib, could they dictate the terms and the timing of potential peace agreements?
Sana'a can dictate any terms of to end this war, and they have actually put many initiatives saying that the war must stop, and that the blockade should be lifted, and that all foreign troops should actually leave Yemen, and they can do that by attacking Saudi Arabia. But one of the main idea for the Saudi coalition, why they have actually doesn't want Marib to fall, because as you said, if Marib will be liberated, this means that there is no more fighting between Yemeni in the north, and then Sana'a will focus actually on liberating the coast of Yemen, to liberate as well south and east of Yemen from the Saudi-backed forces. And if the war on Marib will continue as it like now, and if there is no serious step to liberate the city, this means that the Saudi actually have won the war in Yemen by dividing all country, by making Yemenis to fight each other. And I think that the United States and other country, if they really wanted peace in Yemen, Sana'a still have this deal on the table that Saudi should stop all its attack in return that Yemen will stop their attack against Saudi Arabia or against forces inside Yemen.
Okay, final question goes to you, Elijah Magnier. You had about 10 days ago or so, the U.S. making an announcement that is pulling out THAAD missile systems and military arsenal and equipment out of the West Asia region, and included countries like Saudi Arabia, like Jordan. That doesn't quite go with the scenario that's unfolding still in Yemen in terms of the war continuing. I've always wondered, and I've asked this question throughout the war, and I'm going to ask this question again. Do you think that this war would end with one phone call from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia?
Yes, I do believe so. I believe the Americans, the one who are negotiating today on behalf of Saudi Arabia, can end the war anytime. The Saudis don't have the upper hand. They don't have the authority to negotiate and to end the war in Yemen. It's an American war, and it's bigger than Yemen. It goes to bigger picture, what is happening in the whole Middle East and the rearrangement of the Middle East and who is going to control what. We see China and Russia moving in, and Russia is moving in aggressively. So the Americans are feeling the heat under their feet, and this is why they are afraid of what's going to happen next and who's going to win in Yemen. And they want to try and strike a deal. That's why they want to end this war by winning, and the Ansarullah are not allowing them to win because they've started their aggression in 2015. They have to end it today.
Okay, thank you very much for that. We do appreciate your comments there. That was Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Thank you. Hossein Bokhaiti, thank you so much. Activist and political commentator there from Sana'a. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kaveh Tahrawi, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham. Take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint,
a critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. This is the movie critique program of the Viewpoint, and so far we have been talking about a couple of movies hovering around the concept of cloning with our dear guest, Sayyid Abdullah, and Brother Hussein. Brother Hussein, salam alaikum, welcome to the studio.
Alaikum salam, happy to be here.
Welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we've been talking about this fairly new phenomenon of cloning. And we had lots of movies about this. And we just chose a couple of movies. So far, we talked about The Sixth Day in 2000, and also Godsend in 2004. And now let's focus on another movie, which is, in fact, fairly new movie, 2018, Andover. Of course, the release day was 2017, I guess. Well, but basically it was famously received, in fact, in 2018. It was directed by Scott Perlman. I didn't recognize any of the characters. They were not famous, but they played a good part, and they acted well. Well, the story is like this. A desperate genetic professor clones his wife over and over again until she is the perfect recreation of the woman he loved after her death. Because it happens that the professor loses his wife, and then he comes up with the idea and dares to clone his wife, all right? But sometimes within the process, some small details go wrong, and then he has to get away with the cloned wife, and then reclones his wife in this movie. Sayyid Abdullah, what is so important about this movie? What caught your attention about the message that this movie is trying to convey?
Well, first I have to say, if you get attached to your wife, and there's this special bond between you and your wife, and there's special love, and, you know, love obviously works in different levels, but some people, their whole existence rests around one person, that they cannot enjoy anything unless that person's with them. Like, they go outside, they would wish their wives were with them, they eat something nice, they would, you know, would want their wives to be with them. So these partners, they become part of their life. Losing that partner to a lot of people is unbearable. Mm-hmm. They can't bear having lost a loved one, especially if it's a partner that they spent a lifetime together or a long time together. So they would, you know, they become desperate to find that love, because they know they're not going to find it elsewhere. And even if they might find it elsewhere, in the back of their mind, it could not replace what they had. Could even be better, you never know. But mm-hmm. they just don't want to risk that. Like, you know what? I'm comfortable. It's their comfort zone. I want that love. I want that person because they understood me to a special level and we had this connection. I want that. So this movie trying to portray that kind of message where they're saying, you know what? What if me as a scientist, I had the ability to create my wife again mm-hmm. and have that love with her again? Because this is the whole aim of the movie now, leaving the science fiction aside, leaving science aside, leaving everything aside. He wanted that love. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, he did not get it. He got it somewhere else.
I see.
As life took place. So this would be the you know, the focal point of this whole movie, in my opinion.
I see. Let's take a break, and we'll be back continuing our discussion on this movie, Andover.
I can't believe you made that.
I did.
I love you. More than life itself.
So, howdy, bro.
propose?
You married to a Dawn Slope?
I am.
It's been an accident.
I just wish I could say goodbye to her.
We all do.
I can't live without her.
Well, you can't live with her.
I guess God just couldn't wait to have her back. What if I told you we could have her back? I could clone her.
It's against nature.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the movie Andover, 2018 science fiction romantic comedy. Well, directed by Scott Perlman. Brother Hussein, Sayyid Abdullah was referring to a very important issue that, first of all, he was talking about love, and then it's too unbearable for some people, in fact, to accept a shock such as the loss of a dear one, all right? And we sometimes know that, actually we learned it from psychology, that some people are so much attached to those things that they belong to, they have a sense of belonging to those things, you know, and they don't want to let go, all right? And it seems that this is one of the messages of the movie, don't you agree?
Yeah, that is true. That is with the main character, the professor, that's what he is. He's too attached to his wife, and when she dies in that fire, he can't help but replace her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with her, by cloning her. Of course, then he runs into some problems, but that is his initial standpoint.
I see. The funny thing within that serious message that I found out was that life insurance adjuster isn't really too convinced about this, and he always feels that there is something fishy about this genetic professor, and doesn't believe that the wife is dead yet. All right.
It wasn't very clear to me why he didn't believe, but yeah, that was quite humorous.
I see.
For me.
Okay. How about you, Sayyid Abdullah?
I think that the whole insurance auditor thing, I think that itself was another message of the movie, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you remember, he kills him, and he makes a clone out of him, and he brings him back to life. So this is the whole message of the movie itself. Maybe it had the cover of love and, you know, I want to bring my loved wife. But what if the possibility is there that, let's assume for argument's sake, you're a government official.
Mm-hmm.
And you came across sensitive information that you shouldn't have, or even just a normal person that you should came across something you shouldn't have. If the government can kill you, right, and reproduce you, make a clone out of you,
yes,
to the stage where you know everything except the fact where you were killed,
mm-hmm.
right, or why you were killed,
yes,
that is the because he kills him, he brings him back to life, he gets him drunk, and then he calls the police,
yes,
right, he gets arrested. And what if that was a possibility? So we can get rid of you,
yes,
as a person, and we could make another copy,
yes,
out of you,
yeah,
and no one would know.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was like a hidden message within the message itself.
Mm-hmm.
That if we had this capacity, or if we had this capability of cloning people, even if it might take us in the same way that took him so many trials to get his perfect wife, we might try. We
mm-hmm.
might succeed, but when we succeed, we have you by the neck.
Mm-hmm.
Right, that
yes,
you do something against us, we can get rid of you, we can replace you easily. So
yes,
that could be also a whole idea why this annoying insurance person was around.
Yes, but personally, mm-hmm. I think the playwright or the director was somehow influenced by this proverb in English that says, nothing is certain except death and tax. It's somehow synonymous with each other. Like we have the death, of course, somehow annulled by the fact of cloning in this movie, and also the insurance person, the life
absolutely.
Insurance adjuster,
absolutely.
Or governmental official who tries to like get away with the tax and stuff like this and insurance policies. And
well, that, I mean, it's an actual theme that if you look in Hollywood movies, especially back in the day. Now it's not as much, but back in the day, they used to use that life insurance as a scam, where you fake your death and then you get away with it. So the auditor himself, his job is just to make sure that you've actually died.
Yeah.
Right. So when he goes snooping around, looking around, and he finds a lot of evidence that this wife is not dead. I've seen hints of her hair out there.
Yes.
How could that work? Maybe he's trying to cheat the system. So, with taxation, obviously they're not going to give you the money straight away. They have to do their search.
Yes.
So yeah.
Obviously, some people in fact try to fake some even accidents. To get the most out of like doors.
Exactly, like even in some movies, if you remember some movies, they would take their own teeth.
Yes.
And they throw it, for example, in a fire or a car accident, or the burned car. So when they take the teeth, they take DNA. That was him.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's not you. They could throw in another body, would throw a piece of something that belongs to you.
Yes.
To make it look like you. So they have their ways. If you want to fake your death, I got many ways I can help you with.
Thank you. Let's take a break and we'll be back.
Professor Slope? You're not thinking what I think you're thinking.
My wife died way too soon.
Professor Slope, this isn't ethically ambiguous. This is completely unethical and absolutely immoral and not to mention totally illegal.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, the host of this program, and our dear distinguished guest, Sayyid Abdullah, and also Brother Hossein. We were talking about the movie Andover, a 2018 American science fiction romantic movie. Well, Brother Hossein, we somehow talked about the idea of soul in the last episode when we were talking about another movie, of course. It was Godsend.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to tell us or tell our audience about differences between mind and soul? We didn't talk about it though then.
I understand, yeah. So the thing is, especially with cloning, when you're trying to copy the person, first you start, I guess, with the body, their attributes, how they look like. But then you have the most difficult part, which is their entity, which is their soul. And most importantly, their mind, which controls what they do, how they act, their reactions, their thoughts. So in this regard, there are technologies out there that can actually scan your mind or know exactly what you want to do and do it. A very recent example is Elon Musk's new company. It's called Neuralink. Basically, according to this article from Daily Maverick, it says that the device would then allow users to control a digital device such as a computer or a smartphone with their minds once that chip is implanted in their brains. So so if this chip can have the capacity of holding like an SD card, for example, a memory slot, it can save your mind, and then when you want to clone a person, you can use that information, you can use that scan to...
And transfer all the information from the previous individual to the next one, right? House.
Exactly. So so it's a very real possibility when you look at it from this perspective in these movies, on how they are cloning these individuals and how their personalities are sort of the same in a way.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, our dear audience, for listening to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. We've been talking about the critique of the movie Andover, a 2018 American science fiction romantic comedy. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Armenian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The world with reporters.
China is building up nearly 3,000 kilometer long network of roads, railway lines, and investing tens of billions of US dollars in Pakistan's energy and infrastructure projects under its mega Belt and Road global initiative. The major road infrastructure links western China to Deep Gwadar Port in southwest of Pakistan, 75 kilometers east of Iran, at the top of Arabian Sea. The U.S. feels threatened over expansion of Chinese economic influence in the rest of the world through Gwadar Port, which also serves as an alternative option for Beijing in the event of military blockade of Chinese Navy in South China Sea by the U.S. and its allies. The U.S. has been pressurizing Pakistan into shelving Chinese mega projects, calling it a debt trap. Washington has been struggling hard to win over Islamabad in its what appears to be a cold war with Beijing over growing Chinese economic influence in the world.
Pakistan thinks that it is very unfair for the US or other powers, Western powers, for countries like us to take sides. Why do we have to take sides?
It's not going to happen that if Pakistan is there's pressure put on Pakistan to change its relationship or downgrade its relationship with China, it won't happen. Our relationship between the two countries, no matter what pressure is put on us, is not going to change.
We do not expect that living at the backyard of such a rising power, which happens to be luckily our strategic partner, how could we downgrade our relation with them and side or be more close with someone who is 10,000 miles away. So it is very unrealistic to expect of Pakistan. Militarily, we would not involve ourselves in the conflicts of the region.
The unprecedented cold shouldering to the U.S. has followed series of Pakistan's policy decisions to no longer get itself involved in any U.S.-driven military conflict across the region. Islamabad has outrightly rejected the U.S. request to set up military bases in Pakistan. The American CIA chief, William Byrne, who was on a secret visit to Pakistan a few weeks ago, was reportedly snubbed upon his request to see Prime Minister to reconsider his decision on military bases. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Aside from the enormous death toll, COVID-19 has wreaked economic havoc across the 27-nation EU. The Brussels Economic Forum, the European Commission's flagship annual event focusing on the economy, has just heard that young people have been disproportionately impacted.
We have a whole generation of youth that have had their education and their early labor market careers disrupted. So we really have to pay attention to those groups and try to move forward better.
Apparently, the EU is ill-equipped to create jobs because it's behind the curve when it comes to the digital technology sector.
Before, we were just lagging behind
the United States and Japan at some stage. Mm-hmm. No, we are lagging behind the US and China.
Education systems in the EU need to be reformed so that young people can receive training for quality jobs, it has been suggested.
If you're from the north of Europe or the south of Europe, the east of the west, young people desire one thing. They want to build their future, they want to build a family, and this comes with a quality job.
The EU's handling of the coronavirus pandemic was criticized at the Brussels Economic Forum. A senior official recalls Russian medical supply trucks rolling into his home country of Italy in February 2020.
They had written in the tracks from Russia with love, and that in the same weeks we had export bans of medical equipment among European countries.
The EU's slow response to the pandemic has economic consequences, experts point out.
The United States, earlier than Europe, made huge progress on vaccines as soon as Joe Biden came into office. It also put forward an even bigger economic recovery package.
The event heard that Western nations rely too heavily on the arms industry and financial services sector when it comes to growing GDP. That's the total monetary value of any given country.
In contrast, imagine a good society, a harmonious one, where people feel safe, where they are healthy.
Contributors reminded the Economic Forum the EU was still struggling from the 2008 financial crisis when COVID-19 arrived. They warn if citizens are not treated better this time, the EU will fall apart. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes in positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government, officials, factions, and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020, which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with a deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes, in an airstrike near Baghdad Airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
The 10th session of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union, hosted by the Iranian broadcaster, the IRIB. The event brought together representatives of 300 television and radio channels from 33 member states who attended the event through video conference. This year, the session was held with the motto of media justice and freedom of speech.
The 10th General Assembly of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union comes as the websites of several of its affiliated media outlets were seized by the U.S. government, something which the union views as an attempt to silence dissenting voices.
Last week, the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation confiscated the websites of Press TV and three dozen other Iranian and regional media outlets for what it described as a means to combat disinformation. Addressing the ceremony in Tehran, head of the IRIB, Abdul Ali Ali Askari, condemned the U.S. move as an open violation of freedom of expression, calling it a failed attempt
to muzzle the truth. The extent of the effectiveness of resistance media outlets prompted the U.S. government to breach its own norms regarding free speech and take down those media. So this shows that those media have been successful. But the West must know that their move indicates their weakness, and on the other hand, the seized media will not stop working.
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union is a multinational entity, which is currently comprised of 228 member media outlets from 33 countries, covering a total of 22 different languages. The main goal of the union is to break the Western monopoly on media and to offer an alternative narrative for regional and global developments, as opposed to the narrative presented by mainstream media. The union says the West has engaged itself in a full-scale media war to silence the alternative voices.
The slogan of freedom of expression is just a tool for the West to impose its will on different countries. Those media outlets that speak the truth and enlighten the minds of the world nations face censorship just because they expose truths that come at the expense of Western interests.
Head of the IRIB World Service, Peyman Jebeli, says the West can no longer pull the plug on the resistance media since they have already reached global audience, including Western societies.
This time, we witnessed global solidarity with the people of Palestine in their resistance against Israel. Hundreds of thousands of people in Chicago, London, and elsewhere in the West voice their support for Palestinians. Does the U.S. think it can prevent the voices of Palestine resistance from reaching America by blocking our media outlets?
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union says any attempt by the West to take down independent media is doomed to failure, and they will continue to shed light on the truth. However, member media outlets say they will sue the U.S. for its illegal media crackdown and will take measures to restore the seized websites. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Britain has a new man in charge of the country's health service. Former Chancellor Sajid Javid replaces Matt Hancock to helm the most under-pressure department in government. First point of order, attempting to manage the COVID crisis.
I want to see the restrictions lifted and life going back to normal as quickly as possible. And that's at my right here and now, that is my absolute priority.
But this is no ordinary cabinet reshuffle. Previous Health Minister Matt Hancock was forced to step down after embarrassing revelations about his private conduct were made public.
I understand the enormous sacrifices that everybody in this country has made, that you have made, and those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign.
Despite presiding over the shambolic handling of Britain's COVID response, it became clear that Hancock had fallen out of favour inside Downing Street.
I think it's really likely he was pushed. The exact provenance of the CCTV footage from within his office is not clear, but it's clear that it would be very hard to access that if you weren't in some way strongly connected to the government. So if Boris didn't want him to go, someone did very much. Quite clear that his position was no longer tenable.
For those hoping there'd be a change in approach from the new health chief, they may well be disappointed.
There is no ideological difference between Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock. It's a new face, just as Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt became an absolutely figure of hate while he was presiding over the NHS, precisely because he was implementing these ongoing privatisation policies. We're living with the consequences of the NHS being driven into the ground. We've seen unprecedented, really corruption, giving away, gifting tens and hundreds of billions during this pandemic. Sajid Javid, I have no doubt, will continue in the same line.
Britain's National Health Service was already creaking at the seams even before the pandemic. And for the millions who've been waiting to see a medical professional, well, they won't mind who is in charge of the health service. They just want to be made better, and made better soon. With COVID dominating the health agenda, Sajid Javid will have his work cut out for him. And as the fate of his two predecessors has shown, landing the top job is the easy part. Mina Taylor, London.
Rights activists, along with families of terror victims in Iran, attended this gathering in Tehran. to mark the American Human Rights Week. The annual occasion aims to shed light on the U.S.'s record of rights violations in Iran.
We're marking the American Human Rights Week to review the numerous cases where the U.S. openly violated human rights in our country, like the American Navy's downing of our passenger plane in 1988, after which the perpetrators received a badge of honor in the U.S. The latest crime the U.S. has committed was to assassinate the spearhead of the fight against terrorism, General Qasem Soleimani.
The second day of the week-long occasion marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of the Iran Islamic Republic Party in Tehran by the U.S.-backed Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials of the Islamic Republic were killed, including former Justice Chief Ayatollah Muhammad Ali Beheshti. Iran says it has lost over 17,000 people in terrorist attacks. 12,000 of them were killed at the hands of the formidable MKO terrorist group. What's even more shocking is that the U.S. does not regard the MKO as a terrorist entity and has even established intimate ties with them. The U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist organization. Following this measure, the group was relocated from its former stronghold at a U.S. military base in Iraq to Albania and France. Ever since, the MKO has held regular meetings with American and European officials.
Members of U.S. Congress regularly meet MKO leaders where they offer any kind of support to the terrorist group. The U.S. is still supporting the terrorists in their anti-Iran campaigns. The MKO killed our top nuclear scientists, and that was not possible without the U.S. and Israel's assistance.
I lost my husband in the 1981 bombing of the Islamic Republic Central Office by the MKO. Interestingly, the spearhead of the terrorist operation, whose real name is Ali Mohtamed, took refuge in the Netherlands, and they welcomed him until a few years ago when the MKO disposed of him as a lost cause.
The American Human Rights Week started on June 27th, which marks the anniversary of the failed assassination of the then-Iranian president Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei by the MKO terrorists in 1981, and will end on July the 3rd, which coincides with the anniversary of the U.S. Navy's shooting down of an Iranian passenger plane in 1988. Organizers of the occasion say the ultimate goal of the week-long ceremonies is to expose the U.S.'s double standards when it comes to the issue of human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Farmers, traders, and exporters of agricultural crops held a demonstration in front of the United Nations headquarters in Gaza to deliver the representative of the United Nations a protest letter against new restrictions imposed by Israel to export Palestinian agricultural crops like vegetables. Israeli closure of borders has led to a huge damage in the agricultural sector of the Gaza Strip.
We have come here to protest against Israeli closure of borders. We want to sell our products in the West Bank and other parts of the world. Israel intends to ruin our lives by adopting such restrictive measures. We call on all human rights organizations to do something.
Palestinian farmers are facing serious financial losses due to the Israeli closure of borders. This is viewed in Gaza as part of a larger plan by Israel to destroy Palestinian economy. Palestinian farmers called on the international community to be committed to its responsibilities and pressurize Israel into opening the borders.
Israel's new restrictive measures will ruin our crops before they reach the target markets. All of our vegetables are stuck here and eventually destroyed. I'm standing here to protest these restrictions that have made our lives unbearable. We demand opening of the borders so we can export our products. This blockade is inhumane.
Along with the Israeli ban on export, the latest aggression on the Gaza Strip has doubled the damage in agricultural sector. This has led to severe losses in this sector as Palestinian farmers can barely afford the living.
Our message to the United Nations is that Israel's measures are aimed to deteriorate life of all Palestinian farmers and traders. The latest Israeli aggression has inflicted a heavy blow on the agricultural sector. Israeli restrictions have no purpose but to ruin agricultural sector of Gaza.
Due to the Israeli ban on the exportation of goods, the prices for agricultural products in Gaza have dropped significantly. Palestinian farmers and traders here say that the Israeli restrictions imposed on exporting crops aim to destroy the Palestinian economy. They call on the international community to end these restrictions and open the borders. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Demonstrations against Palestinian Authority over the death of Nizar Banat, an activist and outspoken critic of the PA, keep going on across the occupied West Bank. In the city of Ramallah, these protests turned violent as the protesters who began to march to presidential compound faced a group of PA president's security officers in plain clothes. The forces blocked the rally, chased and attacked the protesters who were chanting slogans against the PA and its president. Palestinian security forces in riot gear fired tear gas and stun grenades to disperse the protesters. Palestinian factions condemned the use of force against the protesters, saying people have the right to peacefully protest.
The people see that the investigation is slow and that the Palestinian Authority has not yet condemned the killing of Nizar Banat. So people are taking to the streets to ensure those behind Banat's death are put on trial.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohamed Ishtayi said an investigation was launched to investigate Banat's death. Palestinians are demanding a swift, independent, and a transparent investigation. Palestinian rights group made an initial autopsy, saying that Banat took blows to the head, and the wounds indicated an unnatural death.
We need to take some practical steps within law that require justice, investigation, and accountability for those behind Nizar Banat's death. We say there is a need to dismiss this government as well as the heads of the security forces.
Journalists were also attacked by security forces during the protests. The Palestinian Journalists Union decried the grave development in the attack on freedom of expression and the media. Journalists, meanwhile, say condemnation is not enough. They say the attack is unacceptable and should be investigated in order to hold those responsible accountable. Commentators say that what's going on today is only the tip of the iceberg. They say if the Palestinian Authority wants to prevent a possible collapse, it should bring those perpetrators into justice and allow people to freely protest and express their opinion. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
And armed conflict in Yemen 2021 was the title of the recent report of the Secretary General of the United Nations. In a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights, Yemen government discussed the UN report and how children protection could be achieved.
For years now, we have been used to see the United Nations doing the opposite of what it should do regarding the crimes of the Saudi-led coalition. This report in itself is considered a war crime against the children of Yemen. It was clear from the first day of the war in Yemen that the United Nations seeks to legitimize war and crimes.
The ministry said the report of the United Nations is full of inaccuracies and doesn't rely on any investigation on the ground, adding that the report aims to legitimize the Saudi war crimes against Yemeni children.
The most serious inaccuracy in the recent United Nations report is that it zeroed the number of crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition countries and did not mention any of their crimes. Unfortunately, the United Nations accused the Yemeni army of targeting more than 7,000 children, and these numbers are incorrect. The United Nations didn't explain where it has got these statistics from.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. During the war years, Riyadh has committed numerous violations of international law, including using internationally prohibited weapons in its air raids, which have killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
Besides the ongoing Saudi siege that prevents millions of Yemenis, including children, from getting food, medicine and fuel, Saudi airstrikes have also killed more than 4,000 Yemeni children alone, according to rights organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.